The Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris is the very busy co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, where along with the Reverend William Barber II, she is helping mobilize activism on the most important moral crises of our time. In addition to a powerful message, she's got to have a darn good lawyer because she keeps getting herself arrested and yet is free to join us again here on State of Belief Radio. Liz, how wonderful to have you with us again. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
You have been so, so busy this summer. In just the past couple of weeks, the march on the Texas Capitol in defense of voting rights, the recent women's march, and now the massive action in Washington last Monday, does it feel like we're reaching critical mass on these issues at last?
So, indeed, I think the spirit is moving. The Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, you know, held a launched a season of nonviolent moral direct action, because when the Senate said that they weren't going to pass that $15 an hour minimum wage increase, when they said that they weren't going to decide on the For the People Act, when we're living in a country that has 140 million people who are poor and low income, and yet the eviction moratorium wasn't being continued, all of this, you know, all happening at the same time with this onslaught of voter suppression laws being, you know, stated and brought into reality. And, you know, already 18 states with hundreds being suggested in 49 states, you know, we, the people that are kind of most impacted by both voter suppression and economic injustice and systemic racism, ecological devastation, this war economy, said, you know, this is a time for action. And it's been it's been inspiring to see, you know, the groundswell of activism, of holy uprising that folks are engaging in. You know, when we marched from Georgetown, Texas to Austin and were gathered with thousands, tens of thousands of people, you know, in a very short period of time, when almost more than folks have ever seen in Washington, D.C., engaged in massive nonviolent civil disobedience in front of the Hart Senate building. You know, I think what we're seeing, and people from all over, all walks of life, you know, are seeing that they have to do their part in making sure that we defend this democracy and put out the injustices that exist that just do not have to be.
Where is the ongoing resistance to justice coming from?
Well, I think we both see ongoing resistance coming from the bottom for change, you know, resistance in terms of political activism and organizing. But what we're confronting is, you know, I think a status quo, a political system that has gotten very used to, for the past 50 years, generation, not bringing issues of systemic racism and economic justice into the forefront. I think we've gotten very used to, you know, a political system that is easier to kowtow to the Chamber of Commerce and the wealthy elite, rather than the needs and demands of the people. And so, you know, again, we've seen some positive change happen in the last couple of months that show that if we go in that direction, change is possible, right? I mean, something like the child tax credit, which actually lifts, you know, a large segment of people from the bottom so that people can actually, you know, thrive more in the society, but it's temporary. And it just shows the potential. You know, we can celebrate it, but we can celebrate it. That shows that if we put our minds to it, if our elected officials actually, you know, are interested in ending poverty, in addressing systemic racism, in saving the planet, and in shifting this war economy that is so used to the militarization of our communities rather than the thriving of our lives, that real change is possible, and it's tangible. It's there. But I think that, you know, again, what we saw, for instance, with the For the People Act, you know, Senator Manchin from West Virginia was supportive of it when John Lewis was alive, when McConnell was the majority leader. But now that Schumer is, now that that it has the potential for it actually to go through, we've seen the Chamber of Commerce get very worried and then get into the ear of Manchin and other senators and put pressure, put real pressure. But what we know is that in history and in our current day, when the people organize, you know, folks from West Virginia, like we have in our Poor People's Campaign, folks from Arizona, you know, putting pressure on Senator Sinema, you know, folks here in New York where I live, you know, putting pressure on Senator Schumer, and all of us as a nation putting pressure on President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris to actually use the power that folks have to pass the kinds of policies that the vast majority of Americans are asking for and that will benefit, you know, so many people, especially from the bottom up.
When someone asks you what are the key issues the Poor People's Campaign is focusing on, what's the answer to that question?
So in this season, we actually have pulled out five issues because we can see that it's within the possibility of the Senate before it recesses to pass. And that means ending the filibuster, and not just ending that filibuster to pass a voting rights bill, but ending the filibuster so that is blocking the expansion of healthcare, that is blocking, you know, making people compromise too much on an infrastructure bill, you know, that is being used to uphold, you know, policies that are not to the benefit of all, especially not to the poor and low income. Mm-hmm. So the second demand is about passing all the provisions of the For the People Act, not watering it down, not leaving dark money in our politics, not saying, well, we'll just be okay with passing a Voting Rights Restoration Act when it's written, because it's not written yet, right? Uh-huh. And so for folks that are saying that they're supportive of that, but they're not supportive of the For the People Act, you know, our question to them is, well, does that mean you're for dark money in our politics? Does that mean that you don't want, moms of all kinds to be able to you know, have drive-through voting, you know, and to have automatic registration at the age of 18, because again, like folks can go off to war, you know, but they registered to do that, but they're not automatically registered to vote. So the third is about that voting rights restoration. The fourth is about connecting this voter suppression attacks with economic justice and immediately passing a federal minimum wage increase to $15 an hour. And then the fifth is about our immigrant brothers and sisters, mm-hmm. the fact that we need protections and dignity and rights and a solid pathway to citizenship for all 11 million undocumented immigrants. Mm-hmm. Now, those five demands are just some of the overall agenda of the Poor People's Campaign. Mm-hmm. You know, this past spring, congressional leaders introduced a resolution that is inspired by our agenda. It's called the Third Reconstruction, fully addressing poverty from and low wages from the bottom up. And in there or in our Jubilee policy platforms, you know, there's a whole lot of other issues that come out of the struggles of the 140 million poor and low income people. Yeah. But in this season, this month, by August 6th, we're saying these five things need to happen. And if they do, we'll celebrate them and keep on organizing. And if they don't, you know, we're going to intensify our organizing and our agitation.
Liz, I worry that the political religious right has been effective at disconnecting religious morality from matters of economic and social justice in the minds of many. So when people ask, why are reverends leading these campaigns? Why are these religious issues? What do you tell them?
So I love this question, right? I was raised in the church, and I am an ordained minister and a biblical scholar. And that's because I have read our texts and our and studied our traditions. And there are more than 2,000 scriptures in our holy texts that talk about how a nation is judged by whether they welcome the immigrant neighbor, whether they are putting forward programs that lift from the bottom, welcoming the homeless, you know, taking care of children and orphans and folks that have whose wages are too low. Right now, if you start in Genesis and you go through Revelation, you know, what you see is over and over again, an arc of talking about these questions of economic justice, and not just on a personal level, on a societal level, right? That last judgment in Matthew 25, you know, he says to the nations that are gathered, if you feed me, if you care for me, if you clothe me, if you house me, if you visit me when you're in prison, then what you've done is done this to Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. And when you haven't done it, and again, it's not just as individuals, it's not just as individual congregations, it's as a nation, we will be judged by how we have treated the poor and the marginalized. And so it's from that this interreligious moral movement from below is really, you know, building power. And we have folks from, you know, denominations and faith traditions that represent millions of people across this nation who see that the moral issues of our day are really about raising wages and expanding healthcare. I mean, the very things that our sacred texts speak so much about, but have now been, you know, separated from kind of a personal morality and a sense of salvation without saving the soul of our society and lifting from the bottom. Mm-hmm.
Specifically on voting rights, why do you think all people of faith and of no faith need to engage and engage right now on this issue?
So what we're seeing happening right now in the United States is the biggest attack on voting rights since the Reconstruction right following the Civil War. And if the kind of voter suppression tactics and legislation goes through like it's being proposed, you know, who will be impacted the most is those that people of faith should be most concerned with. It's the poor, it's women, it's Black people, it's Native people, it's low-wage workers, it's LGBTQ folks, it's the differently abled, right? And again, if we go back to our texts, if we go back to our traditions, the idea that people have a voice and need to have a voice in the decisions that determine their lives, that is a through line through our texts, as well as this commandment over and over again to organize society so that everybody's needs are met. It's not that we should allow for voter suppression tactics to be, you know, smuggle in politicians that then prey on poor people. That's exactly what the prophets are so riled up about throughout our traditions. That's exactly what Jesus, you know, says, woe to you hypocrites who have focused on these, you know, issues of filibuster and compromise, but neglected the weightier matters of the law, and which is justice for women and for the poor and for people of color. And so this is a moral issue. And we must see it as so. And we must see that if we're not loud about the issues that Jesus and God care the most about, then we're not really following in the footsteps of those that we profess to honor and worship.
In late July, you were out front at the Women's March in our nation's capital. What was the focus of that event?
So on July 19th, we had an amazing event with about 100 women from all across the country. It was on the anniversary, the 173rd anniversary of the Seneca Falls Convention, where women had gathered with Frederick Douglass and others to put forward a declaration of sentiments. And we said, as women from all races, ages, genders, sexualities from across the country, that as our voting rights are being attacked, we were compelled to put together a statement that talked about the disparate impact and the immoral obstructionism of the Senate and of the White House that is refusing to act on these issues that are impacting women by far the most. And so it was a beautiful action with women from all around the country who were willing to put themselves out there and risk arrest to make sure that this that this message that voting rights is a struggle that women should be taking up, that all people of conscience should be taking up, and that there's a movement that's calling forward people to act justly in this moment.
I am assuming that ongoing plans are in place for keeping that issue front and center even as we get into the autumn months. Would that be right?
That's right. I mean, we're going to have to keep up the pressure around, all of these demands from this season, the connection between voting rights and economic justice, the connection between systemic racism and ecological devastation, the connection between this false narrative, this moral narrative that's out there that again, blames poor people and immigrants and women for, all of society's problems. Tries to pit us against each other and then feeds us this lie that this is as good as it gets. And so instead, we are going to keep on organizing, keep on mobilizing, and keep on building a powerful movement that has the power and the ability to be able to kind of make the power structures say yes. Say yes to voting rights, say yes to anti-poverty work, say yes to addressing systemic racism, when right now we're still hearing too many no's out of those in power.
Now, this past Monday, there were hundreds of arrests at Poor People's Campaign March in Washington. What was the focus of that event?
So that event was led by low-wage workers and faith leaders. We still were putting forward these five demands of this season of ending the filibuster, passing the For the People Act, restoring voting rights, raising the minimum wage to 15, and protecting all 11 million undocumented immigrants. But this, in this case, it was, is really emphasizing the moral necessity for faith leaders to be out there standing hand in hand with low-wage workers. You know, in this pandemic, we started calling low-wage workers essential, right? Mm-hmm. But folks are still not being paid enough money to be able to afford all of the essentials of life. And this, given the fact that senators were elected, that the president was elected with a platform of raising the minimum wage, and we haven't seen it happen yet. Mm-hmm. And so we were really focusing on the intersection between economic justice and voting rights, and not separating out saying we're only here for voting rights or we're only here for a living wage, but seeing the interconnection of these issues and seeing that in particular in the lives and in the demands of low-wage workers and of faith leaders.
In both of those events, people who were there were caught by the police and been arrested. I wonder, what do they arrest you for? And then let me just put with that, do you think the growing arrests are an attempt at intimidation, or is it a sign that the movement's growing?
So I think what was kind of amazing about the charge, both on the Women's March action, as well as in this one this past Monday, is that the charge, the citation is for obstructing. It's for obstructing traffic. But to me, that feels very important because we're calling out the moral obstructionism of the Senate and of the White House at this moment. And instead, what's being put on us is that because we're making our voices heard, because we're delivering our demands to the Senate, because we're insisting that our politicians actually follow the will of their constituents. Like, for instance, in West Virginia, 79% of Democrats, Republicans, and independents all support the For the People Act. And yet Senator Manchin stands and says that he's not gonna sign on to it because there isn't enough unity around it. Well, 79% of everybody, that's a lot of, so that's obstructionism. And so to be charged with obstructing feels very appropriate in this moment, because we're really where the obstructing is going on is in that Senate and in that White House. I think that the numbers are because the movement is growing. And because people are saying that they are willing to put their bodies on the line to stand up for what's right. And that in this moment of history, to have people coming forth, including many folks that have never engaged in nonviolent direct action before, including folks that, just heard that we were doing these actions and felt like they had to be there in the numbers, including low-wage workers who have a lot going on just to keep families fed and housed, but who felt like they were compelled to take this action, I think it shows the power that's growing.
Liz, tell our listeners again, please, how they can be supportive and involved in what you're doing.
So the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, we're organized in almost 45 states across the country. We have local coordinating committees of impacted leaders, of moral leaders, clergy, activists, advocates from all across these states that come together, organize together, hold up some of the local struggles and issues that are going on, connect it with a state legislative agenda, and then participate in these nationally coordinated actions. So if folks, no matter where you're living, please connect with the Poor People's Campaign. You can go to the Poor People's Campaign website. It's www.poorpeoplescampaign.org. You can text us to join. You can sign up for our e-newsletter. But that way you get a chance to hear about the powerful work that folks are doing and be a part of it. We are saying that this is a movement moment and it needs everyone.
The Reverend Dr. Liz Theoharis is co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, which is currently leading a season of nonviolent moral direct action. Keep up with all that's going on at www.poorpeoplescampaign.org. Liz, thank you so much for using your one phone call to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.